One of the great choral pieces written by Handel, celebrating this chapter of Isaiah 53. I don't know if you knew that, but that's from Handel's Messiah. And this chapter has produced such poetry, such music, such celebration over the years. It's just worth remembering that as we come just to look at it tonight. Because I want to begin by asking you a question, really, just a very simple question. What are you doing here? You don't have to answer, it's rhetorical, but what are you doing here? What are we sitting here for tonight? What have we got a table for? I don't know if you're used to seeing a table like this, but it's got some glasses, some cups of grape juice on, and it's got some broken bread. What's it doing here? What are we singing for? Why are some of you young people doing Christianity Explored at the moment? Why tomorrow morning am I standing in a crematorium saying goodbye to a good friend and committing her to God with a certain knowledge that she's with Jesus in heaven? Why? What are we playing at? Well, it's all about Isaiah 53. It's because of this, because of what God has done in history. And there's a good thing to think about as we start, isn't it? That if this didn't happen, let's stop pretending. Let's just pack it in now. You've got to decide, is this real? Are we actually thinking about something that happened in history? And if it didn't, let's just, you know, turn this into a bingo club or another wine bar and I'll go and retire and let's just have some fun. And what is it that Paul says? Eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. But if you go back into Isaiah 52, verse 10, chapter 52, verse 10, what God has done in history, the prophet is writing 700 years before, and he says, the Lord will lay bare his holy arm in the sight of all the nations, and all the ends of the earth will see the salvation of God. And he's done it, hasn't he? That's what Jesus came for. That's what the old man said in the temple when he saw him, a light in the Gentiles, the nations, and the glory of your people Israel. It's happened. The Lord has laid bare his holy arm before the nations, and all the ends of the earth have seen the salvation of God. And if you look at the other side of Isaiah 53 to chapter 54, God tells them what he's done. He tells us what he's done. Verse 7, for a brief moment I abandoned you. This was the Jews. But with deep compassion I will bring you back. In a surge of anger I hid my face from you for a moment. But with everlasting kindness I will have compassion on you, says the Lord, your Redeemer. What a thing to get up tomorrow morning and know that the Lord's everlasting compassion, that's his love, that's his kindness, that's his grace, is with us, whatever our age, background, color, pursuit, gender in life. He's with us. The Lord rescuing his people, chapters 52 and 54, and there's great joy, great excitement, great hope, great salvation. And it leaves us asking the question, how will it be achieved? How does he do this? And that's the bit in the middle that we've read tonight, from verse 13 of chapter 52 to the end of chapter 53. And this is the phrase I just want you to remember tonight as we look at this. Rescue for me at infinite cost for Jesus. Remember that? Personal rescue for me at infinite cost for Jesus. It says at the beginning of verse 13 of chapter 52, see my servant, behold my servant. It's another one of these servant songs in the book of Isaiah. But this is the famous passage, the one we're coming to, and it's perhaps the most quoted in the New Testament. And think about that. If you're thinking about Christianity, you're trying to sort out in your mind, is this true or not? Isaiah is writing it. We've got the scrolls. He's writing 700 years before Jesus comes. But 700 years before, he writes these words, and they are the most quoted in the New Testament, as Jesus perfectly fulfills what Isaiah wrote about him. Now, that's not magic. That is God doing something in history that was so significant that he told his people about it beforehand. Who is the servant? There was an Ethiopian eunuch who was reading Isaiah 53 in a chariot one day. Some of you will have heard this. It's in Acts chapter 8. And Philip is told to go and get close to the chariot. And he hears the Ethiopian eunuch reading this chapter. And he says to him, well, who's he speaking about? Of himself or someone else? And we read, beginning at that very scripture,
Isaiah 53. He preached to him, Jesus. Yeah? Someone from Ethiopia, Central Africa somewhere, being up to Jerusalem in his chariot reading Jewish scrolls, Isaiah 53. A man called Philip goes and gets alongside it. He's got a Greek background. He sits next to him and hears him say, well, who's he talking about? And he says, it's Jesus. So this song is about Jesus. And someone has said we're on holy ground. That just means it's a bit special to Christians, really. That's just a polite way of saying it's very special. But as I started to look at it, somebody suggested, why don't we just read it and leave it at that? Just read it and reread it because it's so moving. Well, that would be great. We could just do that, and we will do something like that in a minute. But my aim tonight, and I think God's aim, is that we understand it. And not just understand it, but we actually feel it. Do you know what I mean? When Peter had messed up big time in his life, Peter the fisherman, big, burly fisherman, you know, champion of, I can fish anywhere, any time of the day or night. Little teeny bopper girl chewing, blowing bubble gum. You was one of them, weren't you, mister? Peter falls over. No, I don't know. I've never met him. When Jesus restores him, he says to him, Peter, do you love me? He doesn't say, why did you do it? What were you playing at? Didn't you know about temptation? Were you so weak? He just says, do you love me? And I think sometimes whatever we've done, whatever mistakes we've made in life, sometimes Jesus just comes to us and says, look, I'm not wanting to work out all that's gone on in your background and all the messes you've made in the past and so on. I just want to know at this moment in time, do you love me? And I think as we read this, we'll find out in our own hearts whether we love him. But then he says to Peter, okay, if you do love me, I want you to change. I want you to go and do something. See, so we hear something and understand it. We feel it in our hearts, and then we have to live differently. But only when we've understood it and felt it in our hearts. So this fourth servant song, it's got five sections, for those of you interested in these things, and each section has three verses. That makes it very easy, doesn't it? Five sections of three verses, and they look like this. Okay? And this, do you want to hear a big word tonight? Learn a big word. It's called a chiastic structure, a chiasm. That's because it's almost like a first half of a cross, and the word chi in Greek means a cross. So you get the theme at the top, the next theme, and then the middle theme, which is the most important, and then you go back to the other theme and the first theme again. So it's like an arrow. But in the middle is this key bit, which normally has, well, I should have put arrows there, a central axis around which everything else is mirrored. And we'll come to the central axis in a minute. Those are the five sections. Success, suffering, substitute, suffering, and back to success. So let's look at these five sections very briefly. See my servant. The first one, verses 13 to 15 of chapter 52. Success. He's going to act wisely. He's going to be raised and lifted up and highly exalted. He will be successful. That's all you've got to think about in these first three verses. He will be successful. Raised, lifted up, and highly exalted. What passage does that remind you of, you veterans of the faith? Raised, lifted up, and highly exalted. Philippians 2, yes. Therefore God has highly exalted him and given him the name which is above every name. If you want there, you've got the resurrection, the ascension, and the reign at God's right hand. But in the process, notice this, verse 14, in the process he becomes unrecognizable. Now you got that? Here's the person who's closest to your heart, God's heart, the Father's heart is the Son. And in the process of him becoming human, his appearance was so disfigured beyond that of any human being. People say that when you were crucified, you almost looked less than human because of the disfigurement on your body and on your face by the whole process. And have you seen the film, The Passion of the Christ? It's quite an old film now, isn't it, The Passion of the Christ? But the suffering scenes in that are so graphic that it makes you realize that Isaiah was telling you exactly as it is. You see, he's going to be successful, but in the process, he's going to become unrecognizable, less than human. Rescue for me. He did it for me, remember, unrecognizable, but infinite cost for Jesus. But verse 15, fruitful in the end. He will sprinkle many nations, sprinkling the idea of sprinkling the blood to make them clean, and kings will shut their mouths at him. Fruitful in the end. And Paul uses the end of verse 15 in Romans to say, that's what I want to do. I want to go where they've never heard about Jesus, where they, what they were not told they will see, and what they have not heard they will understand. And listen, guys, this is what we see today. He's sprinkling many nations, isn't he? Isn't he? What have we just heard from Kosovo? Our friends Andy and Helena, another young person become a Christian. Exciting, isn't it? Sarah Atwood in Bosnia. And just on Friday, I met a Roma man from Slovakia. A guy from Slovakia with a Roma background who'd become a Christian in this country. His dad had had a dream about the end of the world. A lot of people from that sort of background have dreams and visions, and he had a dream about the end of the world, and his father kept going to people saying, what's this dream about the end of the world? And everybody just laughed at him and said, don't be stupid, it's not going to happen. And then he described the dream to a pastor in England who told him about the end of the world and Jesus coming back, and he became a Christian. And he led his son to the Lord. People from Roma backgrounds becoming Christians. He will sprinkle many nations, success in his ministry, but suffering first. Who has believed our message? There might be success, but who's going to believe this? The Lord has bared his holy arm, as he said he would do in chapter 52. But who's believed our report? Who's believed our message? And to whom has it been revealed? I mean, why on earth are we doing Christianity Explored in this church? Because so many people don't understand it. Who has believed our report? John gets very frustrated when he writes his gospel. The reason they couldn't believe is because Isaiah said, who has believed our message? And Paul gets very frustrated with the Jews in Romans, his book of Romans, and he says, they haven't believed because it says, who has believed our message? I had a young lady from the church in tears this morning saying to me, why won't my parents believe? Why won't my relatives believe? What is it? Ollie's just talked about the unquenchable fire and the gnashing of the teeth and so on. Why won't they believe it? It's so serious. Because he's so insignificant. This is why. This is what you feel, isn't it, when you look at Christianity. Look what he says here. He grew up before him like a tender shoot, like a root out of dry ground. Pathetic, weak, scrawny, insignificant, foolish. That's what it feels like, doesn't it? Those of you who are thinking about trusting Christ. Those of us who trust Christ. We get into debates with people, we talk to people about Christianity, and it just seems so insignificant. And I feel the frustration of, what was his name? Was it Nathaniel? Can any good thing come out of Nazareth? You know, it's a bit like saying the Messiah's come from Bacup in Lancashire. You know, where's Bacup? I don't know. It does exist, doesn't it, Fred?
Small town,
yes. Can any good thing come out of Nazareth? So he wasn't special, he was unattractive, he was ignored, he was rejected, surrounded by pain, sickness and sadness, completely despised. And John sums it up and says he came to his own people, but his own did not receive him. They crucified him. And it's still the same today. Who has believed our message? But you're hearing it tonight. You've got to make up your mind, haven't you? Personal rescue for me, infinite cost for Jesus, not only unrecognizable in human form, but completely despised and rejected. And then the substitute in verses 4-6. People may not believe, kings may not understand, but look at verse 4. Surely he took up our pain and bore our suffering. People may not believe, but this is what he did, surely. And I showed you that clip of that bit from Handel's Messiah because I remember years ago seeing a conductor get very frustrated with the choir because every time he brought them in, they go, surely, surely. He said, no, it's surely. You know, it's surely. That's how it is in the Bible. Even he was getting really frustrated with them. I don't know whether he was a Christian or not, but he got the force of it, you see. It's surely. It really is true. He took up our pain and carried our sorrows. And it says, doesn't it? Surely he took up our pain and bore our suffering. Matthew quotes from that in Matthew's Gospel, chapter 8, that Jesus' healing ministry points to the fact that one day he will heal everybody who trusts in him. Yes?
He has borne our pain, took up our pain, and bore our suffering. Now, that's very personal, isn't it? He's taken my Parkinson's, and one day he'll heal me from it completely. The young lady I met today and talked to today that I hadn't realised who's had such a damaged background at the abuse of somebody else, he's healing her, and he's going to heal her completely. But nobody recognised it. They didn't look. Yet we considered him punished by God. We thought he was the baddie. Do you see that in verse 4? We considered him punished by God, stricken by him and afflicted. We thought he was being punished for his own sin, and God was angry with him. Come down from the cross, you Jesus, they said, didn't they, if you are the Son of God. But you won't come down because you're not the Son of God. Ha, 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 ha. Crucify, crucify, crucify. And then that central axis in the middle section is verse 5. Do you see this? But he was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for, come on, the punishment that brought us peace was on him, and by his wounds we are healed. It was for us. And for those of you who go to university and hear that he was just a nice, loving example, and he was a good teacher, and he was a moral, you know, standout man and so on, look what it says. It was for sin. It is about sin. He is a substitute. It is penal. The reason I'm saying that is that we believe in this church, and lots of Christians do believe in the truth of penal substitution. He took our place, was punished, penalty for us. And that's what it says, exactly. He was pierced for our transgressions. One of the books that I've got that was brought out a few years ago in response to people teaching against this was a big thing by lots of modern day Christian scholars, and the title was Pierced for Our Transgressions. And the last verse there in that middle section, we all like sheep have gone astray. Each of us has turned to our own way. That's a very good description of all of us these days, isn't it? Everybody going their own way, individualism, consumerism, do it my own way. But the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. And Peter uses that phrase about the sheep at the end of 1 Peter chapter 2. Rescue for me. The Son of God pierced through for my transgressions. Just think of one thing you've done this week that you're just ashamed of. I won't look too hard at any particular people. I'll look at myself. He was pierced for that transgression. He was crushed for that iniquity. And so in verses 7 through to 9, we're back to suffering again. Unjust persecution. By oppression and judgment, he was taken away. Downtrodden, mistreated. And yet, what was his response? He didn't open his mouth. Led like a lamb to the slaughter. Nobody protested. Nobody cried out. Nobody realized. Nobody said, that's not fair. A number of years ago, when my kids were very small, I was up in the Peak District, and we were watching some sheep shearing, you know, in one of the farms out there, and there was this pen of all the sheep, and they were bleating and bleating and bleating. They probably knew what was going to happen. But as soon as the shepherd went across and grabbed hold of the sheep and flipped it on its back, it went silent. Everyone else was still bleating, but the sheep that was actually going to be sheared fell completely silent. And this woman next to me suddenly said, isn't there some writing somewhere that says, like a sheep before its shearers is dumb, so he opened not his mouth? And I'm thinking, say something to him, that's the Bible. You've got an opportunity to witness here, and I couldn't think what to say. But she'd got it just right. She'd quoted from this, hadn't she? And that's spot on. It's exactly what happens. As soon as they flip them on their back to shear them, they don't open their mouths. And so he's crucified with criminals. Look at that verse 9. You people who are thinking about Christianity so seriously. He was assigned a grave with the wicked. Is that right? Crucified with criminals and with the rich in his death. Who's that about? This is 700 years before Jesus. That evening, a rich man named Joseph of Arimathea came and begged Pilate for the body. He was a good man. waiting for the consolation of Israel. Fulfillment of the very word, assigned a grave with the wicked, crucified with criminals, and yet he was put in a rich man's empty tomb. The exact fulfillment, 700 years later. Personal rescue in God's great plan of rescue for people like me and you, yet at infinite cost for Jesus. But then the song ends with success again. I think verse 10 is staggering. Yet it was God's will to crush him and cause him to suffer. Notice that. It was God's will to crush him and cause him to suffer. It was God's plan to make him a offering for sin, literally a guilt offering. And then look what happens. He will see his offspring. And the will of the Lord will prosper in his hand. There we are, children, prosperity. The Lord will see his offspring, or Jesus will see his offspring, and the will of the Lord will prosper in his hand. He sees you tonight. Should we just come to an end here? Should we just look? He's looking at us. He will see his offspring. Yeah, he's smiling. This is the fruit of what he's done. And the will of the Lord is prospering in his hand. Therefore, he will see the light of life and be satisfied, and he will justify many. Do you see it all happening? Children, prosperity, the knowledge of God across the world, sprinkling many nations, justifications, rescue for me, but infinite cost for Jesus. But look at him now. Therefore, I will give him a portion, verse 12, among the great. That's probably not the best translation. I will give him the great as a portion. He's not just going to have a portion among the great. He's the greatest. But the spoils of his victory are given to him so that he can share out gifts in Ephesians 4 among men and women. He will divide the spoils with the strong. And this lovely phrase I read, death ushers him into sovereign dignity and power with his own hand administering the saving purpose of the Lord. Isn't that great? I'll just say that slowly. Death ushers him into sovereign dignity and power with his own hand administering the saving purpose of the Lord. My messed up life. At the age of 18, he steps in and turns me around. Rescue for me at infinite cost for Jesus. Suffering, substitute, success. What do you think about it? What does it make you feel? Crushed for our iniquities. And what will you do? What do you think about it? What does it make you feel? And what will you do? We're going to have a different time of response tonight. I'm going to sit down, and Kevin, for a couple of minutes, is going to play some music reminding us of the cross, so we can meditate on it and think about it. And then when he's finished, I just love a number of people just to say which bit of this Isaiah 53 really touches their hearts. Just read the phrase. Don't have to say why, but just read the phrase that really moves you and touches your heart. So just a couple of minutes to look at Isaiah 53. Personal rescue for me at infinite cost for Jesus.